When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Oh my God, Trish, what is that big furry thing there?
It's Margot.
She's
very attracted to my computer screen for some reason.
She's not. She's just passively aggressive, messing with your mind there, trying to stop you doing stuff.
No, messing with your mind, I think you're fine.
Because your cats.
She's just showing you her luxurious tail there, and you're ignoring it. Look at it. It's a thing
of beauty. I've got something to show you, Margot, I tell you.
Hello. Welcome to Postcards from Midlife.
I'm Trish Halpin.
And I'm Lorraine Candy. And we're on a mission to tackle all the big and small issues that affect women at this stage of our life. From insomnia to mind and body wellness, HRT to sex drive, careers and relationships. And as always, the challenges and joys of parenting teens.
In today's episode, we'll be slaying the midlife sleep dragon. So whether you find yourself wide awake and fretting at 3 a.m. or just can't get to sleep in the first place, sleep specialist Catherine Pinkham, founder of the Insomnia Clinic, is here to give us some much needed answers.
And if money is one of the things keeping you up at night, we'll also be discussing how our attitude to finances can affect everything from our relationships with our other halves to our friends and family. So what do we need to do to ensure our children recognise the value of it and go out into the world money-wise rather than hopeless spendthrifts?
First, though, we thought we'd have a little reality check and share some of the moments that have cemented for us that we are well and truly middle-aged, whether we like it or not. Lorraine, you had a little bit of a wake-up call recently, didn't you?
Yes, I'm very uncomfortable with this because, you know, I veer towards the end of Madonna J-Lo aging.
Yes,
rather than
indeed.
Normality and reality in the middle bit. So I was out in Soho, woohoo, for the first time in ages and ages with a very close friend of mine. And I remembered I'd first met her in Soho and we'd had a brilliant night out the first night we met. We'd stayed out all night, gone to a club, come out of it. It just was brilliant. We had a fantastic time. So we were sort of 30 years later, I guess, 25 years later, out in the same street doing the same things. And as we were chatting about how fabulous that we can still be going out, et cetera, et cetera, I realised I couldn't read anything on the menu in the restaurant because my middle-aged eyesight was, well, it was infuriating and I had to borrow her reading glasses.
Oh, I mean, that's just a given for me. I went out with some girlfriends for lunch the other day and we had two pairs between us. So we were passing them round. We had to take turns.
But don't you remember that with
get...
your relatives, with your mum going,
yes.
Oh, for God's sake, she's going to get her reading glasses out. If there's a sign of being an older woman,
yeah,
it's that sign. I find it depressing. You don't find it depressing so much, do you?
I don't, but there is one that I can't believe I'm going to say this. There is one thing for me that was the moment.
Is it what happens when you sneeze?
No, it's worse. First grey pube.
Oh, Trish, for God's sake.
First grey pube. It's awful.
What happened? Did it leap out at you like some awful monster?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, the thing is, I sort of don't really look down there very much these days. And you kind of need your glasses on to see anything anyway, don't you?
Oh, for God's sake, do you want to borrow my reading glasses for your shower shenanigans?
My inspections. Yeah, but I mean, it's a thing though, isn't it? It is. Grey pubes is a thing. And I think... We don't want to talk about it, but we just need to be honest about it, don't we? And it's just one of those things. And I mean, I'm sure there's places you can go to have it dyed, maybe.
What would you dye? All orange or pink?
Well, I suppose, I don't really know. I suppose a lot of women don't have any at all, do they? I think your J-Lo Madonna age end.
Nothing.
Probably nothing.
Hairless, like like Kim Kardashian, hairless.
Yeah, Hollywood, what are they called, waxes. And then
able
you've
to
got...
wear high-rise swimming costumes with no cares in the world.
Yes, exactly. And then you've got us with, because that's where we have to rub our testosterone cream, isn't it? So
it's not where I'm rubbing mine, Trish. Okay. What instructions have you been given?
Do you want to share that?
Well, this is the trouble. I just really rail against this lack of glamour in getting older. But then if you don't talk about it, you're kind of denying it. And the patriarchy wants us to deny everything anyway about women and getting older. So then I feel guilty about that. And then I get myself tied up in all sorts of knots of what I should and shouldn't be talking about or moaning about. I guess if we can be honest, that's the key, isn't it?
Yeah,
really?
Yeah, exactly. But we'd love you all to share your midlife.
I don't want pictures.
Wake up, thank you very much. Don't need pictures.
No.
But actually, because we've had quite a few little stories on our Facebook group, haven't we?
We have.
And I liked this one from Francesca, who says, well, my brain has totally gone today. Put the washing machine on, turned around and realised I had forgot to put the washing actually into the machine. Perimenopause brain is driving me mad. And I think we can relate to that.
We can all relate to the keys in the fridge. I call it the keys in the fridge syndrome. Or that thing that I did last night where I walked across the kitchen six times to the fridge, and every time I got there I had forgotten why I was there.
I think you end up having to be like a detective, because you've got to sort of retrace your steps and your thought process to work out what sent you to that cupboard or that place in the first place. So it's a bit of brain training going on there.
And someone else wrote in the ratings and review section of the podcast, 72 poodle, quite like that, poodle. I have been recommending this podcast to all my friends. Perhaps I shouldn't listen to this on dog walks, as laughing and smirking can make you look like a real mad woman. But hey, what's another affliction at this age? There's a whole list of them, isn't there? Exactly. I don't want to be doom and gloom though, because there's
quite a lot of funny things. And there is the sort of whole like not giving a stuff about it as well. There is that side and the liberating, not
caring. I don't care about a lot of stuff.
Don't care.
Truly don't care what anyone thinks anymore, which is great.
Now it's time to meet this week's special guest, Catherine Pinkham. Catherine has helped thousands of menopausal and perimenopausal women reclaim their nights in midlife. A former NHS psychological practitioner specialising in poor sleep patterns, she set up the Insomnia Clinic in 2013 to specialise in supporting those who struggle to get through the night without waking up. Welcome to Postcards from Midlife, Catherine.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me.
As we all know, the quality and quantity of sleep you get does decrease during menopause and perimenopause. And we know from Postcards from Midlife and from all the experts we've talked to that it's often the main symptom that women take to their GP. So they may not know they're in perimenopause. They may just think, why have I suddenly got this terrible insomnia? So can we just start, Catherine, by exploring why sleep is an issue during menopause and perimenopause?
It's such a huge issue for women in menopause. And the reason I started kind of specializing more and more in this area is because over time, what I saw was that the vast majority of women, either pre, post, perimenopause, wherever they are in that cycle, were having issues with sleep, and that they just weren't being offered any treatment. You know, it was kind of, the obvious stuff, give up caffeine and don't eat spicy food. But really, if you didn't want to take medication, you had to put up with it. And so the reason why it's such an issue for those women is the way that insomnia develops is that for whatever reason, even for somebody who's not in menopause, something triggers the odd night of poor sleep. So it could be stress, a cough and a cold, a bit of noise next door, something on your mind, or it could be a hot flush or the beginnings of your hormonal changes. And what happens is we are pretty intolerant to poor sleep. So fairly quickly, we focus on it, we become quite vigilant about it, and we want to improve it. So for any of us, after three or four nights of poor sleep, we're looking to fix it. So the first thing we do is we go to bed earlier. We try and get more opportunity for sleep. So we would get up later. We would perhaps have a nap if we could. And the problem with those kind of changes is that what we're doing there is we're altering our body clock and our sleep drive. We're sort of starting to interfere in those things. And as time goes on, what these ladies are finding is that they're waking up regularly through the night because of hot flushes. So they're spending more and more time in bed trying to get more sleep. They're getting less. And now they're spending so much time in bed awake, frustrated, feeling panicked, that actually the relationship with bed has become very fractured. We're relating bed to all of these non-sleepy, non-relaxing activities because we're spending so much time in bed feeling that way. And so as time goes on, particularly for these women, what's happening is they're spending too much time in bed awake. They go to bed with this sort of dread and this fear because they know what's coming. They wake in the night feeling panicky. and the next night the same thing happens. So we have this kind of double whammy of not only are your hormones interfering, but now this kind of learnt behaviour and this bed becoming a cue for poor sleep and a place of anxiety is helping kind of cement that problem.
How desperate are the women who come to you? Because I guess by the time you go to an insomnia clinic, you've tried everything else.
Yes. Yeah, we're always the kind of the last port of call because there's so many things that are easier to do and quicker, like taking medications and that kind of a lot along the way. But those things don't tend to tackle the right problem. They're kind of a little bit more marketing and more gimmicky, you know, buying sprays and supplements and that kind of thing. One lady who was trying, when I did the assessment with her, she was currently eating cottage cheese before bed every night because she'd read about this cottage cheese. And I mean, there's also things like cherry juice or copious amounts of kiwis and potatoes. And they've tried everything, you know, they're very desperate. And often even just being able to explain to somebody, actually, you don't have to accept it. And there is kind of a formula and a theory behind why this is happening. And therefore there is, you know, evidence-based techniques that will in some way, they won't get rid of your menopause. They're not going to get rid of the hot flushes, but they are going to minimize the impact that it's having on your sleep. And often for people, even that sort of 10-minute call can be a weight off their mind.
So talk to us about your methods then, because the sleep drive is a very important part of what you do, isn't it? Learning about the sleep drive, and it's CBT based, isn't it, what you do?
Yeah, so CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, is the evidence-based treatment. It's with the highest evidence base for curing insomnia. And it's shown in studies now. There has been a few studies done around ladies in menopause with some good results.
Yes.
And so it's based on not just our thoughts and our beliefs about sleep, but also our actual physical behaviours and physiological response to sleep. So in order to sleep well, one of the things that's the most important is our sleep drive. So if you think of an elastic band, when you wake up in the morning, we start stretching that elastic band. It gets tighter and tighter and tighter as the day goes on. And ideally, we want that band to be as tight as it can be. Then we get into bed, we fall asleep quickly, and we take back the whole debt that we've been building up through the day. But when that sleep drive starts to falter is when we're being woken, for example, by hot flushes. And then suddenly we're feeling really tired during the day because we were woken. So maybe we go to bed a bit earlier. Maybe we get up a bit later. And then you can see that actually we're starting to spend perhaps...
lose the elasticity of the day.
We lose the momentum. So, I've worked with ladies who are spending, you know, 9, 10, 11 hours in bed, but asleep for, you know, 4 or 5 of those.
And it's not just getting to sleep, it's waking up, isn't it? That's a lot of what we hear. And I found that I was fine going to sleep, but I just kept waking up. And that's the fury of everything, isn't it? Waking up cross, hot, anxious, depressed.
Yeah. And so sleep onset insomnia is falling asleep, and then sleep maintenance is the insomnia that probably menopausal women suffer from the most. And, you know, it's a habit that if I was to set my alarm for 2 a.m. every night for a week, by next week, I'd probably wake up at 2 a.m. without setting it.
Yeah.
And so for ladies in menopause, what's happening for them is their hormones are setting these internal alarms. They're boiling hot. They wake up and you feel so panicked and anxious that your adrenaline is racing. And adrenaline is kind of the, you know, the antidote of sleep. You know, it's the worst thing we want coursing through our veins when we're trying to be asleep.
Can you tell us then, Catherine, about your approach and your course and why it's so different and why it's so successful as well?
The first thing that I always do with people is sort of the behavioural stuff. So making sure that we are going to bed a bit later, getting up a little bit earlier. So minimising time in bed so that it's more likely to have that high drive. And although for people that can feel quite anxiety provoking because they're thinking, well, I don't want to get less sleep. Now you're telling me to go to bed less. Actually, it's about doing the opposite to what we think we need to do. Strengthen that drive and the quality of your sleep will improve.
But the most important thing for these ladies as well is, as you say, their problem is often waking in the night. And so what do we do to stop this connection being made with our bed about anxiety and panic? And there's a couple of things that I always get people to do. The first one is, if you are wide awake, hot and bothered, panicked, stressed, not remotely, you know, sleepy, then leave the bedroom. Don't stay in bed when you're feeling that way. And it's really hard for people to do that because actually they're already shattered. They don't want to give up on the possibility of having more sleep. But actually, whilst you remain in bed, your chances of falling asleep are pretty slim. And what you're doing is you're continuing to build this relationship with bed that isn't about sleep, It's about being wide awake, fractious, irritated, tossed, hot and bothered and tossing and turning. So you leave the bedroom, you go downstairs. I don't at all sign up for that you have to do something boring. You do what you enjoy. If you enjoy reading, read. If you want to watch TV, do something that actually just takes your mind off the fact that you're not asleep. Just enjoy doing something else. And when you feel sleepy and you're a little bit calmer, you go back to bed. Whatever happens, you try and still get up with your alarm in the morning. It's really important for this sleep drive to get up. And I know that, you know, people won't feel like doing that. It's the last thing you want to do. But we're looking longer term here. You know, let's improve the quality, and then we can get more of it. But during the day, it's vital that we deal with how we feel about this sleep problem, because it will come back. We can try and ignore it all day, but at nighttime it comes back and it sort of sabotages your mind. And that's that racing mind thing. So in the daytime, it's really important, pen and paper, 20 minutes a day, just to write down all of your worries about sleep, all the reasons why it matters. You know, not getting enough sleep means a different thing to different people. And if you have this sort of core belief that actually, if I don't sleep well, I'm a bad parent or I can't do my job well, that's fueling this issue. It's creating more and more stress. So sometimes it's just about, and I work with people a lot on this, it's just working out why does it matter so much to you, and how are those thoughts helping you? How can we take the sting out of it a little bit? How can we learn to just accept that, yes, it's not ideal, and no, you probably won't sleep as well as you did in your 20s, but actually you are going to cope and you will be okay, and you do still have good days even when you haven't slept well. And getting people to sort of take some of the focus and the vigilance away from sleep, because then when they go to bed, and as long as they're kind of keeping this stronger drive and they're managing these thoughts, they can start to feel less stressed. The less stressed we feel, the better the sleep becomes.
So having CBT for insomnia sounds like it could possibly be expensive, or it could be like a long program. Can you just outline what actually the commitment is in terms of your being involved with it?
Traditionally, CBT for insomnia was always delivered one-to-one, so in traditional therapy settings, and that can be expensive and it can be time-consuming. But over the years, I've been doing this for about 15 years. And over the years, what I realized is actually there's lots of people that don't need therapy. They actually just need to know what to do. So we offer one-to-one therapy because some people need it. They have anxiety, stress, and they would prefer that approach. But we also, I developed an online course, and it's sort of based on a 4-week program, but you take as long as you want. You carry on past that. But the 4 weeks are sort of based on the elements of the program. So looking at your behaviors and your body clock, looking at your thoughts and your anxieties, looking at relapse prevention. We're all going to have a bad night here and there in our life. How am I going to stop that one bad night spiraling? So looking at those stages. And what I did was I created the online course. I've got a menopause course and a normal course. And what I do is I have a support group, because I think that people always have questions. They want to know if they're doing it right and they need to get those answers. So the support group people can ask, and I'm always there to answer questions. And it's a lovely group. People realise they're not alone. There's a community.
Yeah.
And that in itself is helpful, because insomnia is lonely. At the moment, it's £225, and that includes the free membership of the support group.
You're doing a webinar, aren't you?
Yes. So I've got currently on the website, there is a Sleep Well, Live Better webinar, but I'm going to do one that's specifically for menopausal women.
How do you feel about antidepressants in the mix for sleep? Because a lot of women, are prescribed them, a lot of women need them, and it is relevant as a prescription. Yeah. But a lot of those women are still experiencing terrible sleep issues. How do you work around that?
So I think that if somebody has a lot of anxiety and stress, and they're struggling to manage that, that's the primary issue. So if they can't, if I'm trying to work with them on their sleep, but actually the anxiety of even going to bed half an hour later is, you know, crippling them, then I would say in that instance, actually, some medication to help with your anxiety or your low mood can give you that kickstart that then you could stick with this sleep program and improve your sleep. Some antidepressants have a sedative effect, but it's not normally enough to cure an insomnia problem, because actually we're not dealing with the root cause. You know, we haven't retrained ourselves to feel differently and to sleep at different times.
And how long is a good night's sleep? What's in your mind is a good number of hours to sleep?
So I would never go on quantity. When we're younger, we find it much easier to get more deep sleep. You know, when you're 18, you can sleep in every single morning, regardless of what you drank or ate or you've
So annoying.
It doesn't matter. When we get older, we seem to spend less time in deep sleep, and it's almost harder to get there. And the older we get, that's the case. So what I always say to people is, rather than looking about the hours, look at how much you can get, which is quality. So a good night's sleep for me would be if you fall asleep fairly quickly, so in under, you know, a half an hour, 25 minutes, if you wait to go to the toilet but can get back to sleep again, and you can stay awake during the day. If you're kind of achieving that, then that's decent quality sleep.
Right.
But it's often this focus on 8 hours that causes. So I've worked with ladies before who are getting 7 hours, and that's actually perfect. They're doing well on 7 hours. They're a bit stressed and they're a bit tired, so they're trying to get 8, and they cause insomnia by trying to get 8 because actually that's just...
Oh, gosh, yeah, it's a vicious circle, isn't it, really? I mean, talking about teenagers, I mean, you're very much like you go, your bed is where you sleep, and then you get out of your bed and you leave your bedroom. I mean, for us, it's a bit of a nightmare because teenagers spend so much time in bed because they're now watching TV in bed on their laptops there. And it is, you know, it's very difficult to take those off them. It's easy to not put a television in someone's room, but it's very difficult to not let them have their laptop. And they spend an inordinate amount of time in bed. What advice would you have for us parents dealing with that?
I mean, I think it's really difficult because, you know, the rules of, you know, don't have any screens 2 hours before bed, etc., are just impossible to impose on teenagers.
Well, you can impose them, but you just spend your whole life shouting at them, which is it's uncomfortable before bed.
Yeah, and the thing is, that won't help them sleep any better. If they're going to bed cross and annoyed, that isn't any better than having watched the program, watched this phone probably. So I think it's probably, I would say just be a bit more realistic with them. So even if the rules are 2 hours, just agree with them what they're willing to do. Half an hour, what time? Like what time would you be willing to put it down? You know, the importance of them not spending loads of time in their bedroom doing the thing which isn't sleep. So maybe compromising and saying, if you're just going to be on your phone or not, could it at least be downstairs? Could it at least be in a different room, not actually in your pajamas, in your bed? And getting them up in the morning, again, I know it's hard, but getting them up early will create that sleep drive, which means they're more likely to fall asleep because it's easy to get your body clock so far out of sync when you're falling asleep at 1, 2 a.m. Getting up late. And lockdowns, obviously, you know,
thrown
everybody out the window, especially teenagers. They have nothing to get up for, so they're on their phones and they're getting up late.
What used to make me really cross more than anything was my husband lying next to me blissfully. Snoring his head off, having God. All that sleep. I'm sure women bring that too, don't they, Catherine? Yeah. This kind of internal fury that someone else can get, your partner can just continually sleep through.
Yeah, oh my God. I mean, so many women have that, and their partner wakes up in the morning and goes, oh, I'm shattered, and I just want to kill them.
It's quite tricky in a relationship, isn't it, to navigate that?
Yeah.
What advice do you give people?
So I guess the first question I would ask is, where do you see the future? Do you want to share a bed, or are you happier? Would you be happier? Yeah. Or would you be happier in separate rooms? If you're very comfortable with just separate rooms, then I'd say if you can sleep better not sharing, then don't share. But look, for a lot of people, that's part of their relationship and they want to share. So what women are often doing if their partner snores is, again, they're going to bed at the same time as their partner. And that's not the right body clock. That's not the right schedule for them. Mm-hmm. So I'd say if you go to bed later, you're going to be more tired. It's going to be less annoying and less apparent.
Oh, you've been so helpful, Catherine. I think that will be really good for all the people who keep saying to us, will you do something on sleep? Will you do something on sleep? And now we have.
Yes.
So thank you very much for
that. Thank you.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
If you want your children to turn out well, spend twice as much time with them and half as much money, which is a very wise quote. But how do we go about teaching kids the value of money? It's such an important life skill. Some thoughts.
Well, I think it kind of starts with us, doesn't it? And how our own attitudes to money are. Yes. And apparently we all have a money personality, don't we?
Do we?
We do. I'll tell you what mine is. I'm a bit of a cautious money person. It does cautious make me quite Caroline. Anxious. Cautious Caroline. It does make me a little bit anxious. But I think I kind of got that from my mum. She was so precise about money. I mean, they didn't have a lot of money and she would account for everything. She didn't actually work, but she managed all the aspects of kind of the finances, you know, from my dad's earnings. And she was a real balance your checkbook. Do you remember that?
When they exactly the same as my mum, yeah.
Yeah, and her favourite phrase was, look after the pennies and the pounds will look after themselves. And I, you know, that always sort of stuck with me. And I suppose that's about being in the detail of your money and what you have. Really good lesson for me. But then when I met Neil at the age of 19, I was about 22. Neil. The lovely Neil, also
multi-billionaire tech entrepreneur. Oh, Neil. Oh no, that's not him, is
no,
it?
That's no, that's not definitely not him.
lovely Neil,
one of his nicknames is Mad Spendy Boy because he just like
not Mad Bendy Boy, which not bendy. I like as well. Spendy. No.
Yeah.
Spendy.
So he was definitely a risk taker. And he was sort of one of those people who get a credit card at the beginning of the you know, the student year, and he'll have racked up the whole max in about 2 weeks.
Did you like that about him, though?
Because well, I it was did. A release was from the constriction. A shock. Yeah. You know, there was I writing down every single 20 pence I spent on a double decker. And he's like,
surprise me.
Yeah, exactly. So somewhere we've kind of landed in the middle. And I think that thing of like one of you being quite cautious and doing saving and the one pushing you to take a few risks is probably quite good. What about you and James?
Well, I've got a very I don't know, I think I'd call it a slightly strange attitude to money. So my parents had very little money when they first moved to Cornwall. They had enough money for I seem to remember my mum saying for food for the week, and that was it until my dad sorted out a job when we were really little. My mum was very careful, like your mum. She kept a little book, I remember her, of everything coming in, everything going out. You know, the power was in knowing what was going on. But I don't have anything to do with money. That sounds really lofty, doesn't it? Like the Queen. Mm. My husband deals with absolutely every aspect of it. I don't know. It's funny, throughout my career, I've never really been driven by money as the element of what I've been lucky enough to earn quite a lot, because I chose an industry that at the time newspapers paid journalists quite a lot and worked very hard, you know, and worked sort of 7 days a week. Mm. So, but I just sort of got to a point where I just absented myself from having responsibility for it, because James was so good with it. My husband was so good with managing it. Now, in retrospect, as a woman, I don't think that is a good thing. I wouldn't advise that, because you lose your power a little bit. And obviously, I trust him implicitly, but I should be more involved. Mm. I know I should be more involved.
Neil and mine's separate approach to money has always worked because we've always both had a source of income. But I think you can really run into a trouble in a scenario where one of you, say, loses a job or decides to cut back on hours or take a pay cut, you know, to start a new career, whatever.
But it should be a constant discussion. So this is, we've run loads and loads of features on it, on all the magazines I've worked with, particularly within relationships. And it's all right, somebody else handling it, but you need to have constant communication. And a lot of women are really terrified of talking about money. Interviewed and employed lots of women who didn't even ask during their interview what the salary was going to be. And I would always say at the end, you're not going to ask me the salary. Talking about it can really change your life once you get rid of the fear of it. I think it's really important that women are taught to do that. I certainly teach my daughters and my son to talk about money. We've been very, I would say, stingy on the pocket money front. Well, they say stingy, obviously, because they need £25,000 a day to fuel their needs. But we gave them pocket money and asked them how they were going to spend it. We got them Go Henry cards. Have you seen those little Go Henry cards when they were little? So there's lots of ways you can get kids involved in money and knowing the value of it.
Yeah, I mean, you have to kind of give them the freedom to manage their own budget, because it will, or their own pocket money, because it will, I mean, there's two things. It will hopefully teach them only spend what you can afford and kind of avoid the pitfalls of
planned expenses. I found a really good website actually called moneyadviceservice.org.uk, and they have a really good section on talking to teenagers about money, and they actually tell you to kind of advise you to talk to them and be really honest and give them examples maybe of where you've made mistakes with money yourselves, what the impact of that was, how you can learn from it. What are your thoughts? And obviously you were at this point, I mean, because there's, in terms of older children, adult yes. children, first of all, paying, if you can afford to, paying student loans at uni and maintenance, because that's quite a big issue, isn't it, for some people?
Well, I think if you're going to, you have to make sure that if you can afford to pay it for one, you're going to have to pay it for the others. Mm. So is that your future earning mm-hmm. going to be able to support that?
Yeah.
But I think it's a kind of day, month by month, year by year conversation, isn't it? I would rather they paid themselves, but I don't want them to get into cataclysmic debt, because that is possible future for this generation, unfortunately.
There's some really great advice actually about the whole uni loans thing, because they're, the way they're structured and the way they pay them back, I think it's really worth understanding that. And there's some great advice on moneysavingexpert.com with old Martin Lewis
is probably the best site we found actually when we were looking at this, because he's very current and up to date.
Yeah, very much so. And it's not the same as paying off a debt. It's kind of structured very differently in how it will end up paying back. And then, you know, I've got friends now whose kids are back from university. They're living at home. Obviously, the jobs market is incredibly tough. And
well, rent in urban areas is hard.
It's just impossible. And I think that's really, that's a really difficult scenario that they're finding themselves in terms of how much do you actually financially support your adult children. Obviously, every family circumstances and everybody's individual circumstances are different. But what I was kind of reading about this is that you really, there's two ways of looking at it. You know, it could be, if you financially support them, it could provide a really good start to your child's self-sufficiency and independence. It might just be the money they need to get them going. But it could also be the thing that keeps them from kind of becoming self-reliant ultimately. So it's kind of how, I suppose it's about knowing your child and your offspring, what their opportunities are and seeing where you can help them. And then also it's about what impact it's going to have on your own sort of future planning with money, because you know, in theory, they have time to get their financial ducks in a row. They can get loans. You can't get a loan to fund your retirement. So if you're using your retirement savings to fund your 20 something who, you know, so there's a lot to consider, and everybody's you know, decision is their own personal decision, but it is worth kind of just reading about it and getting some advice, I would say.
I think getting the information before you have the conversations as well, so you know what you're talking about.
Exactly. So let's keep talking about money. It's tried and tested time. Lorraine, you're doing something fashion-y, which I'm rather excited about, because I don't think we've done anything fashion-y for a while, have we?
No, we haven't, but it is my gift. I am on a crusade for not buying new all the time, not fueling this massive piles and piles of stuff in landfill, all the damage we're doing to the planet. I downloaded an app called Buy Rotation. And it's peer-to-peer, basically. You're part of a community that's sharing pretty nice things. Because I was thinking, if I want to go out for, it's my wedding anniversary, 20 years married. If I want to go out for dinner, I want to wear something really, really special, but I don't want to buy anything. No. But I want to wear something I haven't worn before, so I'm going to rent something. So this is, I think, for special occasions, because there's a lot of really nice high-end fashion here. If you like Chloe, if you like Gucci, if you like Chanel, if you like some of those cool new young brands, Rixo, Ganni, Kitri. So I borrowed for a night out with Mr. Candy a dress by Vampire's Wife, which we all know of them, Trish.
They're lovely.
They're about, well, they're anything between £1,000 to £2,000 in real life, should we buy them in real life. But I hired it for £24 for the evening.
Very nice.
It was really nice. It was a perfect fit. It's brilliant for all my Instagram shenanigans, as you can imagine. But there are lots of other things. So you can rent, so the prices start from £3. And you can rent things up to a Chanel bag worth nearly £6,000. there are lots and lots of sites that do rent now. There's something called ThredUp, T-H-R-E-D up. There's Depop, there's eBay. Instagram have a ton of sites you can follow, accounts you can follow where it's rented or it's swap. You know, you can borrow things from buy rotation for up to 30 days. You either exchange in person, so you find your community, or you send it back tracked. And that's around £7, I think, to send it back tracked. But it looks to me like the future, and it's it was just really nice wearing that really lovely dress. Also, let's not forget it's Secondhand September.
Oh, yes.
This is the brilliant, brilliant initiative that Oxfam UK are pushing and following. Trish, what have you been trying and testing?
Well, I'm back at the gym and I've started to, after, you know, after lockdown and all of that. And I'm doing body pump classes, which Well, you know, it's that sort, it's kind of like little coordinated little weightlifting.
Like you do Jane work Fonda. On the body.
No, because you've got weights and you're changing the weights up and down. But it's kind of like a full body sort of weights workout, which I need to do for my little tiny bird bones to make sure that, they, you know, to try and sort of prevent the old osteoporosis. But I've bought myself a foam roller because I'm sort of fed up of that. I'm fed up of that sort of, you know, like you have about 3 days of aching. So I got my foam roller from Decathlon, and I think you can get them for about £25. And they're either kind of smooth or they can have these slightly little raised knobbly bits on, which is probably slightly more advanced, a bit more painful, but both do a very good job. What you have to do is you have to lie on it in different ways that you are sort of rolling against all the different muscle groups. And I found a really good website, actually, physique.co.uk. So it's a bit painful.
Really painful foam rollering. Yeah. And if it doesn't hurt, then it's not working.
It's probably, I'd say anybody who hasn't done it, if you're going to do it, don't just kind of launch yourself on it and start rolling about. I would, I would definitely follow some instructions. And it just sort of, you know, it just gives you a lovely, it kind of increases the flow of blood and lymph to the muscle, and you get a nice healthy supply of oxygen and nutrients. And it works on something called, do you know what the myofascia is? Do you know what your myofascia is?
Is it somewhere you go on holiday?
Sounds like it, doesn't it? Sounds like Mykonos or somewhere, doesn't it? No, it's it's basically this sort of,
not a Greek disgusting island.
It's fascia, not myofascia, fascia. It's basically this sort of network of fabric that envelops kind of all the muscles in our body and our bones and our organs in this one weird long unbroken structure. And the rolling really kind of you know, helps with that as well. It kind of makes that all.
Can we go back to body pump? Is there music?
Oh, yes, definitely. It's very coordinated. Okay. It's, the tracks are literally, you work to the track, and then it's kind of one of these like
leotard
type. No, not leotard. Leggings, big sweaty sweat t-shirt.
Okay.
Quite a lot of sweating.
Can you lift Neil up yet then?
Maybe not. I can lift Margot.
If she lets you.
Huge fur coat. Yes, exactly. So what have you been feeling nostalgic about this week then, Lorraine?
I've had great joy this week feeling nostalgic. Trish, I'm going to read you something. Mm-hmm. Who said this? Who said this? The best place to be is here. The best time to be is now.
Someone very spiritual and insightful and
Plato?
Clever.
Yeah. No? It's Bill from Bill and Ted.
Oh, you caught me out there.
They also said be excellent to each other. Another one of life's manifestos. Anyway, Bill and Ted, it's coming back 30 years after the first film.
Oh my god,
look at me, our producer, she's, what the hell are they talking about, she's thinking. 31 years, 1989 was the first Bill and Ted with Keanu Reeves, obviously.
Who was the other guy?
Alex Winter.
Oh, right. Okay. Whatever happened to
him? We don't care about him. Care about Keanu Reeves.
Oh, boy, do we care about him.
Oh, I used to have a cardboard cutout of Keanu Reeves by my desk, which someone stole from a film premiere. Matrix, maybe.
Oh, I was going to say, because he's had so many kind of different beautiful incarnations, hasn't he?
What's your favourite Keanu film?
I'm going to go a bit a bit classic, and I prefer the old ones. I haven't done all that sort of John Wick stuff, I have to confess. But
you don't
I
like
think,
violence, do you?
It's not really, and I don't really like sort of Matrix-y things. So I'm going to be a bit boring and say Don John in Much Ado About Nothing. Do you remember?
That's terrible. That's the worst Keanu.
No, he's so gorgeous. But actually, okay, no, I've got a better one. Speed. As yes. Jack Travner or something, isn't he, in Speed?
Yeah, that you was, like him in Speed.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Go on.
I like the, it's gone from my mind because my brain's gone. What's the surfing one?
Oh,
God's sake, how can I not remember that? Hang
it
on.
It was a bit like Speed, but with
Point
surfboards.
Break.
Point Break. Oh, yeah.
Point Break is my favourite all-time Keanu film. Might be in my top five all-time films, I think, maybe. Yeah, and are you going to come and see Bill and Ted with me?
Definitely.
That was
definitely.
A there, Trish.
And, well, I was just thinking, am I going to have to come to North London? I'm not sure about that.
God,
okay. But you told me something before, which
yes.
About your husband.
Oh, yeah. He knows this. If you squint and you stand a bit away,
yeah.
He does bear a passing resemblance to Keanu Reeves.
Shall I tell,
tell me
you
where you've been?
Well, do you know what? It slightly ties in now that you've said about James, because it's somebody that Neil looks a bit like or has been told in the past.
The Rock.
Richard Briers.
Richard Briers. I love him, though.
Well, so I was already thinking about The Good Life, and then you mentioned about Keanu and James. And actually, Neil actually has been more likened to Harrison Ford, but the one that really made me laugh was when he was once likened to Richard Briers in The Good Life. This was possibly, along maybe with Fawlty Towers, the best sitcom. But who is the best character?
Margot's the best character.
Because she is
Do
just
you
this,
mind, Jenny?
Amazing mix of sort of hilarity and humiliation, isn't she? And she's all sort of plumping cushions and complaining about Miss Mountshaft. We're all a bit Margot, I think, aren't we? We've all got a bit of Margot in us. But it was interesting, wasn't it? Because you've obviously got Tom and Barbara and their relationship and Jerry and Margot. But then I think the Tom and Margot dynamic was always really interesting because he always used to just really
get too close to her.
But they had this real sort of love-hate relationship. And then obviously
I think there was a sexual spark, was there not, Trish?
Well, there was certainly was between Jerry and Barbara as well, wasn't he? He was always kind of running after her in her little dungarees and things. But brilliant. Absolute lovely little nostalgia noodle there.
Well, that brings us to the end of our penultimate episode of Postcards from Midlife.
It's going to be the last one next week of series two, isn't it?
I know. No more jibber jabber. No more jibber jabber from us for a while.
Who would have thought we got this far?
I know.
When we did that first one in lockdown, do you remember? Oh, my goodness.
It brings me great joy when I read all the messages and I think of women striding around where they live, walking their dogs or going on runs, just listening to me and you talking about midlife.
Know. We're building a really wonderful community around Postcards from Midlife.
Very funny women. Very funny,
very
smart women.
Funny women. So we'd love you to share your midlife experiences with us on the Facebook group, or you can email us, hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com. And if you're enjoying the episodes, please do tell your friends and all the midlife women you know. And remember to subscribe on your podcast provider and rate and review us too. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.